impactful in your body, and we're grateful that we can present it to you here on WBAI. But we need you in order for us to keep this a closed loop, to keep this circle going, so that we are serving each other. And that means you pick up the phone and dial 212-209-2950. I'm running out of time here, folks. I need you to get on that line. Make that donation right now. 212-209-2950. We don't have much time left, and we need to see the phones light up. Your donation keeps this station strong and thriving. That's why it matters. It's going to impact your health as well as our health. And when we can serve each other, what better way is there to do things? And this has been Questioning Everything with Tony Bates. Thank you for your donations.
FM, WBAI, New York.
It is perfect weather for listening to the radio, moving a little bit closer to your radio. It is Black History Month. And as I've said before, I think that the real value in studying history is to understand the historical legacy, what it means to us here and now. If we look back at where we were, we are in a better position to determine how far we have really come. And as we look at where we are, understanding the lessons in our historical experiences, it kind of helps us understand even better how we should move forward. And so we're going to do that on this edition of From the Streets. With me, I'm Bob Law. A special invitation for you to join me. And I think you're really going to enjoy this. You might set up your recorder and record this show. You know, this is going to be part of your our oral history tradition. You know, most historians point out that Black music has strong Southern roots, blues, gospel, jazz, bebop. They have a history that does indeed have a mixture of Southern experiences as a starting point. But there is a music that was born and nurtured in urban cities, a storytelling music that gave voice to the Northern urban experience. It talked about going under the boardwalk and up on the roof. It talked about precious summer nights and going to the chapel. A lot of it talked about going to the chapel. And it was composed, arranged, and written by the kids who sang it. They sang on street corners. They sang in subway stations and high school bathrooms. That's where the acoustics were best. It was indeed a street corner symphony. It was opera in the truest sense. We called it doo-wop. And it preceded the rhythm and blues greats that reaped the harvest that the doo-wop singers planted. Before there were the hit-making Supremes, there were the hit-making Shirelles. Before the Jackson 5, there was Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers. I'm moving a little bit closer to your radio. Now, for some of us, we will relive some of the best memories of our lives. For others, we will introduce you to harmony and storytelling music. Now, this song by Frankie Lymon, this might be one of the most important doo-wop songs of all time. Bring it, Sean.
Why do they fall in love?
My. Let me just introduce you to my brother, Bobby J. Bobby J is a natural national treasure, an authentic griot who lives this music. He didn't just study it. He didn't just research it. In fact, people who want to study and research it come to Bobby J. He lives this music. He is the best possible guy to help us on this journey to understanding the doo-wop legacy. Bobby J, welcome. Say it again a little bit. Good to have you with me. That's it. You know, Bobby
J. Glad you got cold weather. I'm suffering here in South Carolina. It's 75 degrees as we speak.
See, people do that when they come on the air with us and they're in some warm climate, and then the next day they have a storm. So be careful. Bobby J was part of the dream team of radio broadcasters, disc jockeys at WWRL in New York City. Bobby J was part of that group of disc jockeys who the industry still regards as the dream team. He went from WWRL to CBS FM, and CBS FM at that time was the oldie station. And not only did he play the music and talk about the music, he performed with the Frankie Lymans, with the latest edition of Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, and his own group. Even prior to that, there's a lot of things that he has done. He's been quoted. He has been featured. He's been the source of information for most of the books that have been written about the doo-wop era. There are TV shows, those public TV shows promoting doo-wop, and Bobby J has had a hand in all of that. People who wanted to get it right always go to Bobby J in order to get it right. And so we're real pleased to have him with us here. Bobby, let me just start here. We're going to go back and forth, though, in time. But let me just start here with that song, Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers, and Why Do Fools Fall in Love? The significance of that song, I say it might be one of the most important doo-wop songs of all time. But what about that? Let's talk a little bit about that song and talk a little bit about Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers.
Well, the song was released on, as I recall, January 10th, 1956. And it was... The term crossover had not yet really existed, but that was like the first real crossover record that was made by youngsters, young kids, for young kids. And the record took off all over the world. In the words of the late Sherman Garnes, who was the original bass in the Teenagers, it was the perennial overnight success. And the record was covered by people like Gail Storm, the Diamonds, the Beach Boys, the Jersey Boys, the Four Seasons. So many people recorded that song. And it took the Teenagers around the world.
Now, as we say, these were teenagers. And almost in the whole genre, I don't know if there was anybody at all at that time, as doo-wop was emerging, was there anybody that was 20 years old?
Well, I'm sure there was some, you know, there was some in their early 20s, but you got to understand that there were teenage groups before the Teenagers, but they were singing adult songs. Why Do Fools Fall in Love was the first time a teenage group was singing songs for teenagers. That was the difference. You had groups now, like the Mellow Moods, you had the Solitaires, you had so many groups, but they were singing adult songs. This was a kid's song.
But this music was being performed by kids. It was now a lot of it was a lot of these groups wrote these songs themselves. Is that right?
That's correct. Many of them wrote them, in school, after school, when they hooked up on the street corners. And usually there was at least one, maybe two guys in the group who had some ability to compose songs. Mm-hmm. And that's what they would do. So the groups would naturally sing the songs that emanated from the group.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we stay with Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers just for a minute, they were from New York City. They were from Washington Heights, what is now, well, I guess it was called Washington Heights then. Is that right?
Washington Heights, Sugar Hill.
Go ahead.
They were all from the neighborhood. And Frankie, of course, was the youngest.
How old was Frankie?
13, he was 13 years old when he joined the group.
Whoa. He was 13 years old when he did that song.
Yes.
My. Now, when we say before the Jackson 5, there was the Teenagers. The Teenagers, as you say, on the strength of that one record, that first record, they became superstars. They were on the Ed Sullivan Show. They were performing in Europe at the London Palladium. They were really the first super group. And the lead singer was 13 years old.
Yes.
And the ages of the rest of the people in the group?
14, 15, the oldest 16.
Wow. My goodness.
They were all junior high school students. Edward W. Stitt Junior High School up there in Washington, in Washington Heights.
Mm-hmm. Wow, 13 years old. And now, what did that happen back in the neighborhood when they became superstars? We talked about that once before, how their status changed in the neighborhood. And they were very much supported by their community, by their neighbors. But what was that like for them walking back into the neighborhood?
Well, you've got to understand also the impact that they had on other kids, like myself, who were singing at the same time. But with this phenomenal record, it became evident you can make a career out of this. The guys would walk down the street, and particularly the girls, would say, oh, man, there's one of the Teenagers. There's the Teenagers. And it went even further. Frankie's younger brother, Louis Lymon. Louis said he would walk down the street and say, hey, man, that's Frankie Lymon. No, that's not Frankie Lymon. That's his brother, you know. And it had a tremendous impact, not only on boys either, but on girls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Teenagers, Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers, they also had a very wholesome image. You know, that album, their album had a picture of them. It looks like walking through a park. They had on white sweaters.
Walking on Central Park.
Central Park, yeah.
Yeah.
And white sweaters with a big red T on the sweater. Very different than what a lot of young performers look like nowadays. But as you point out, these were love songs, and these were children. These were teenagers, 13, 14, 15, and they were singing love songs, and they were singing it with a passion. You know, it was believable.
Well, you got to understand the motivation. We didn't know at that time that this was a business.
Mm-hmm.
We sang because it attracted the girls from the neighborhood. That was the primary motivation.
Wasn't the money.
Wasn't the money. We didn't know you could earn money from it.
Mm-hmm.
We believed in those days, you sell enough records, you're going to get gigs. You're going to get shows. And that's how you make money. We didn't know you could make money selling records.
Let me just say it again.
Records were a promotional tool.
But I'm sorry, say it again.
Records were a promotional tool.
Right, right. And people didn't know, those young people didn't know how much money could be made. And didn't really know what rich was. I remember Lloyd Price telling me that when he had his, you know, he was successful from the very beginning with Lordy Miss Claudy. And he said he thought he was as rich as Rockefeller. He said the only reason he thought he was as rich as Rockefeller was because he didn't know how rich Rockefeller actually was.
Yeah.
You know, that these young people, these are kids, neither they or their families really knew anything about the money, how much money could be made. And the record industry was still developing at that time.
That's right. In fact, it wasn't an industry. It was the record business.
Right. But again, these are young people, 13 years old, 14, 15, and they're singing love songs. And the songs would really resonate. This is storytelling music. I'm going to come back to that. But let me just, as we talk about this music and how it resonates, let's hear the and listen to the lyrics and listen to what these and keep in mind, these are teenagers, early teens. They weren't even 19 years old. They were 13 and 14 and 15 and 16 years old. These various groups, the Cleftones, the Flamingos. Here's the, when I talk about these young people singing love songs, consider this by the Flamingos. Bring it, Sean.
My love must be a kind of blind love. I can't see anyone but you. Shabam, shabam. Dibam, shabam. Dibam, shabam. Dibam, shabam. Dibam, shabam. Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright. I only am a rest for you. The moon may be
Jirap Jabop, you know, you listen to that music, and Bobby J, that's a harmony in the truest sense. The
absolutely.
I mean, how did somebody train them? Did people did they go to music school, or you know, how did that just come about that the music was so harmonious, the lyrics were so meaningful? And they sang as kids, singing with that kind of passion.
Well, you know, I don't know too many of us that went to a music school or took music. We listened to the people who preceded us. I'm talking about groups like the Ravens, like Sonny Till and the Orioles, even the Ink Spots,
mm-hmm.
And that's how we developed harmony. We would listen to a record. I remember when I started singing, we'd listen to a record and you would pick out your part. You would say, oh, yeah, yeah. That's the baritone. Okay, I'm the baritone. I'm going to sing first tenor. And you began to blend. And once the blend came, and you knew it when it was there, because it was sweet. And that's how it developed.
Mm-hmm.
But not that many people. I mean, you know, people like Jimmy Castor, who was a part of the Teenagers. Like, he was Frankie Lyman's stand-in and understudy, and he took music in school. But not many people did.
Now, the one of the things about the doo-wop music at the time, it seems like most of the songs had some kind of an opening. Damn, some kind of lip or hey to doom bop. That became the style. Can you talk a little bit about where that came from?
Well, I just mentioned the Ravens. The first bass intro I ever heard came out in 1950. The Ravens recorded a song called Count Every Star. And Jimmy Ricks, the bass, came with do 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 do. do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. That was the first bass intro I ever heard. And then it began to develop. And then when Sherman said, then every record had to have a bass intro.
Let me give you another example. And this is what real popular, everybody thought they could sing this song. And then people who were not singers at all and going to parties and just hanging out and just entertaining yourself. This was a real popular song that just encouraged everybody to sing. Now, the Cleftones, they were from Queens. Is that right?
Jamaica, Queens.
And I don't know how many groups came from Queens. I know the groups came from the Bronx. They came from Harlem. There were groups in Philadelphia. And this was, again, it wasn't a crossover music. It was a music that appealed from the very beginning to everybody. There were white groups doing doo-wop. There were black groups doing doo-wop. There were some groups that were integrated as a group.
There were a few. The Crests, Johnny Maestro and the Crests come to mind. Del Vikings come to mind. And you talk about Queens. Don't forget the Heartbeats also came from Queens.
The Heartbeats came from Queens. All right. They were major. Here's what we mean by that bass intro. Here's the Cleftones. Bring it, Sean. Jamaica, Queens, here in New York City, the Cleftones, indeed. A lot of groups that, you know, we're going to talk a little bit later about Little Anthony and the Imperials. They were from right down the street from where WBAI is, right over in the Fort Greene Projects in Brooklyn. But the music was those kids wrote most of those songs themselves. You know, the lead singer, well, the leader of the Cleftones, was that Herbie Cox?
That was Herbie Cox.
And I think they wrote, I don't know if they wrote all their songs themselves, but the groups wrote that music, they wrote most of the songs themselves. These, again, were people who were 14 and 15 years old and writing lyrics like that.
Herb wrote that one, and then Charlie James, he wrote some songs, and I think Berman Patterson also contributed to the writing of their songs. It was in-house.
It was what?
In-house.
Okay.
In other words, within the parameter of the group themselves, they would come up with songs.
And now, we talked about them being there being love songs. All of it was not love songs. Some of it was whimsical. You know, there was the Coasters and Get a Job. And,
The Silhouettes.
The Silhouettes, Yakety Yak. Let me see if I can put both of those together, give you an idea of what we mean. Let me say again, though, I'm Bob Law. This is WBAI 99.5 in New York City. Our guest and our guide is Bobby J. Bobby J is the perfect person to take us on this journey through the legacy of the doo-wop era and what that music meant. Now, we've already pointed out that these were kids, They were 13. Frankie Lyman was 13 years old. These are kids, all of them, between the ages of 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and writing the music. And a lot of it had to do with how we should love each other. A lot of it had to do with how we should embrace each other. There was no talking about killing people. There was no people saying that I'm just singing about my reality. They seem to understand that the role of an artist is not to reflect what's there. It's not to reflect the so-called reality. But the role of the artist was to help you envision the new reality, help you envision your reality on your own terms. I want to talk a little bit more about that. But first, let's look again. When they say some of it was whimsical, here's, let's see if I can put both of these together. Yakety Yak and Get a Job. Sean?
Take out the papers and the trash.
Dip, 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 dip.
I get a job. Yakety Yak, Don't Talk Back. Now, Bobby J, those are city songs. You know, you talk about this music having a urban, coming out of an urban experience. See, Walk Yourself to the Laundromat. That's a city song. That people in the city understand that. You know, all of Hank, You Don't Get to Go Out at Night. The summer nights were, and it was when we came alive, actually. Everybody, if you had a girlfriend, whatever you were doing in the daytime, you did it. But it was the nighttime when you would go visit your girlfriend, hang out in her neighborhood. Those songs reflected a urban reality.
Well, you must understand, most of the music that we categorize as doo-wop, vocal group harmony, came from the big cities, New York City, Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles. This was city music.
And it reflected that. But it also reflected the aspirations of those young people. These were not wealthy kids. These were not kids coming up in the on the beach. These weren't the Beach Boys.
These were kids coming up in the city.
But they envisioned another future. They talked about loving each other. They talked about respecting each other. And I think that's kind of important to understand that they understood, without having gone through any Black consciousness seminars or anything. That was prior to the Black consciousness movement. But these kids already understood that their vision, their mission, was to envision what could be, to envision a newer and better reality. And I think that's important that people understand the role of an artist in a very real sense. And then again, let's look at, now these are, as we say, these are teenagers. These are the kids who created the market, and they never got paid. They created the teen music market, because before that, there wasn't any teen music radio. There wasn't any, record stores, record hops. There weren't any concerts at the Brooklyn Fox Theater. And, you know, that kind of thing wasn't happening. Young people were going, they listened to the radio at home. They listened to whatever their parents were listening to. So when you mentioned the Ink Spots mm-hmm. were not a group that targeted teenagers as their audience, but teenagers heard the Ink Spots because that's what the adults and their families were listening to. There wasn't any market. There was record stores, concerts, things that we call record hops, and even radio formats. That didn't exist until these kids made it clear that such a market existed.
It's ironic. I'm working on a project now about the disc jockeys and the teenagers of the 50s into the 60s. And in it, we talk about the fact that this music really came about after World War II. That's when the teenager began to have money in their pockets, and mm-hmm. they were kind of tired of listening to the music of their parents. And then with the advent of Alan Freed in Cleveland in the early 1950s, 1951, he started playing rhythm and blues records. He started playing black records on the radio, and the white kids began to enjoy this music because they had heard this kind of music before. And that was the beginning of it.
And it gave birth to a whole industry. Radio formats, radio stations targeting teens, and those formats existed for years, and generated a great deal of money. Record stores now selling a whole lot more records because, as you said, they discovered that these young people had some money to spend and were willing to spend it on records. Then they were doing concerts. Alan Freed, who you mentioned, has having concerts. Here in New York City, there was a disc jockey named Murray the K, and he did concerts. I don't know, did he come right? I don't know if he was there in the 50s, though.
He came right after Alan Freed.
Yeah.
He came after Alan. But then again, you can't dismiss or forget people like Tommy Smalls, Dr. Mm-hmm. Jive, Douglas Jocko Henderson, the ace from outer space, Scooby-Doo, Ralph Cooper.
And they had radio shows on the existing white radio stations. There wasn't black radio at that time. It wasn't 24-hour black music radio, was it?
No. You had stations like our former station, WWRL, which did what we call block programming. They would have Polish, they would have Spanish, Italian. And at a couple of day parts, particularly afternoon drive into the evening, they would then play music for the African-American audience. Mm-hmm. But you didn't have that many black-owned radio stations then. You only had one down in Atlanta for a long time that Jack Gibson came out of, Jockey Jack the Rapper. But this music was big, and I've often talked about in another documentary I did called Sweet Talking Guys back in, I think, 1991, you had people like Alan Freed, who was at the Paramount Theater on 43rd Street and Broadway. But then at the Lowe State, you had Tommy Smalls, and their audiences rivaled each other.
Yeah. It was Tommy Smalls was introduced on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah,
Ed Sullivan couldn't get it right. He said, this is Dr. Jive doing rhythm and roll, and rhythm and green.
rhythm and color.
Yeah. And then he brought on Tommy Smalls to introduce some R&B artists. We're talking with Bobby J. Bobby J is, as I said, Bobby J is a national treasure. And now we can't play all the music. There's so much music. We're going to play, I'm going to play as much as I can as we move with this conversation. But here's what I want you to do. If you, you know, I'm going through this list here. There's so much music. And I wish we could get to all of it. We need to do one time. Maybe we can just do a music show. But there's an encyclopedia of doo-wop. It's a 4-CD set. And it's got so much music. And because I can't get to all of it. But it's got the Five Satins, the Del Vikings. It's got the Chanels, the Silhouettes. It's got the Andrews and the Hearts. It has the Crest, the Belmonts, Louis Lyman and the Teen Chords. He talked about Frankie Lyman's brother also had a group. Some of his music is on this CD set now, and there's so much more. But we will get around to playing as much as we can. But to really thoroughly relive the magic and relive the memory. Some of these are the best memories. I mean, when you hear a particular song, I want you to think about who was your boyfriend at the time. do you remember him? And who was your girlfriend at the time when you begin to play some more of this music? But now, if you would, here's what I want you to do. I want you to call this, Sean, let me have the number. Let me explain it again. What we're going to do is I'm going to give you this encyclopedia of doo-wop. It's a 4-CD set by all of these artists, so many artists. No radio station or radio show could play all of this music not in one day. But you can get it. If you can do a $75 pledge to WBAI, see this, consider this. When you hear this music, and this radio station is the only radio station in New York where this kind of a discussion and this kind of music could be played. There's no other radio station, particularly the music stations, who could ever take a chance on playing this music or gospel music or jazz music. Their formats are so tight and they can't afford to take a risk. But here at this radio station, not only on the music level, but on the level of ideas and information, this radio station is really critical and is going to become even more and more important as we continue to move forward into this political arena. And so I want you to help us maintain this radio station, all right? So I need you to call now. If you call right now, we have the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop Volume 1. It's a 4-CD set, and it's got everybody on here. And it'll help you enjoy this music and keep listening to it throughout the rest of the week and throughout the rest of the summer, and introduce your grandchildren to it. Because, you know, you've got some grandchildren now who never heard of four-part harmony. You've got some children now who really have no idea what music sounds like. But and many of you remember these songs. So for a $75 donation, or you could give more if you like, for a $75 pledge to WBAI, I'm going to send you the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop Volume 1. It's a 4-CD set. As I say, it's got some of the music you've already heard. Get a Job by the Silhouettes is also on there. The Five Satins and the Still of the Night. The Del Vikings, Come Go With Me. And when you talk about the summer, there are a number of songs that reference summer. One Summer Night. There are a number of songs that reference the chapel. You saw me crying in the chapel. I'm crying tears of joy. This music, Bobby J, let's talk a little bit about this as storytelling music. But Sean, what is the phone number to call for the pledge?
212-209-2950.
212-209-2950. If you call, but I need you to call that number right now. Call now and make your pledge so that we can make a point to get you the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop so you can continue to relive the magic. It is a 4-CD set. It's a really remarkable set, and it'll help you continue this energy, you know, to help you continue moving this music forward, as well as helping to sustain this radio station and helping to encourage the people who are here, the content providers that are, for the most part, volunteering our time to bring you this kind of programming and other programming that you can only get in this city on this radio station, 212-209-2950. BJ, remember we used to do that at RL. RL was 1600 on the dial, and we'd say, I'll take the 16th caller from the Bronx.
Right. <You know? laughs>
So this, well, we're 99.5. I don't want to wait till the 99th caller, but we'll take the, I wonder if I can get people from the Bronx and people from Brooklyn. Let me see, in honor of not the Bronx, well, the Bronx as well, but Washington Heights in honor of the teenagers, and Fort Greene in honor of little Anthony and the Imperials. Y'all call right now. Call this number, 212-209-2950, and make a pledge, $75 or more. You get the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop Volume 1, a 4-CD set that has so much music. Now, when we talk about the music, the young people who created this music, a couple of things come to mind. I want to see if we can get to one thing. The young people who created this music never got paid. They created the music, and they really launched the beginning of the music industry, but they never got paid. And part of it was that, as we said earlier, they didn't know how much money they were making. They didn't know you could make money singing. And so the people who were, you said it wasn't an industry, it was a music business.
Yes, it had not yet become the industry that it is now. It was the music business, the business of music.
Now, when we say they never got paid, let's talk a little bit about that. They got some money, but what was that like? And you were there, and you were performing, and you were there. What was that like? How is it that they didn't get paid?
Well, you see, when we signed contracts to record, to make records, and many of us were underage, and so we'd get a big sister to sign for our parents, or maybe, you know, a girlfriend from around the block would sign. The contracts weren't even legal. However, I remember, because I sang the group, my original group was the Aladdins. And I remember we got a penny and a half per record as a royalty. And I was always a big mouth, and I always wanted to know, how do you cut the penny in half? How does that work? And most of the contracts said you would get a penny and a half. Some people got a nickel. Some people got a dime. But that was of 90%. So there was 10% that was taken right off the top. You didn't get any of that. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to fight to get it. I remember the late J.R. Bailey, who was with the Cadillac, and they were working in Washington, D.C. at the Howard Theater, and they had a record that came out called Peekaboo, I'm Watching You. And it really, really was a big seller. And they said, wow, man, look at that. Checking the charts, man. When we get back to New York, man, we're going to go down to Jubilee Records and make sure we get our royalties. Well, they went down to the company, went in and said, hey, man, we're here for our royalties. Royalties for what? Well, so I'm looking at the Billboard chart, man. Peek-a-boo, man. He said, No. We don't owe you royalties. You owe us money. Because take out for every session that you recorded, the artist paid for the session. We paid for the magnetic tape that we recorded on. If you wanted tea and toast, whatever, you paid for that. If you went down
but
to
when, you were, when you were ordering that, when you were in that process, they had not explained that to the performers.
Of course not. First of all, they didn't explain it to us because they figured, and they knew, and they were right. We didn't know what they were talking about. There was no such person as an entertainment lawyer in those days. Mm-hmm. Didn't exist. So you brought the contract home to your parents to look over. What did they know?
If they
had a lawyer at all, it was a probate attorney or a real estate lawyer. There was no one in the legal field who understood what this is. All brand new. This R&B, this rock and roll. This is new. Nobody knew anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we got ripped off.
Now let me just share this with you. There's a book here called The History of Jazz, The History of Chess Jazz, and they're talking about Chess Records, and I believe Chess Records was the model for the TV show Cadillac Records, and Chess Records was owned by the Chess brothers, Leonard Chess, forgot the other brother's name. His name was what?
Phil Chess
and Leonard Chess. Now this is a book that they put out. This is the history of Chess Jazz. And it's a 2-CD set, and they've got a lot of information in here. So a book that includes 2 CDs. But this is not us saying this. This is what they wrote in the book. There are a number of people who worked with the Chess brothers. This guy who wrote this essay is someone named Jack Tracy, and he's talking about his experiences with Chess Records, and he's kind of putting it in a whimsical sense, but he says this. He says, I do recall a time when Leonard and his accountant were preparing the checks for a particular royalty period. Ahmed Jamal was in the midst of tremendous record sales of his LPs, spearheaded by the great But Not For Me. And Ramsey Lewis was still a relative newcomer to the label, still a couple of years away from Wade in the Water. And Leonard looked at the number he was shown as the amount due to Jamal. And he looked again. Then he said, that's too much money for him. Give some to Ramsey. Now, and the guy's going on to say that, as I said, Leonard had his own way of doing business. Now, let's understand what Leonard Chess just did. He stole the money from Ahmed Jamal and Ramsey Lewis. When he looked at the amount of money that Ahmed Jamal had actually earned, and Ramsey Lewis had earned some money, but nowhere near the kind of money he would eventually earn, and nowhere near the amount of money that Ahmed Jamal was earning. So Leonard Chess decided to keep the money that Ramsey Lewis had earned, and take money from Ahmed Jamal and give some of that money to Ramsey Lewis. And that was Leonard Chess saying that that's too much money for him. He was determining the value of what Ahmed Jamal was doing. Even though Ahmed Jamal earned the money, Leonard Chess was not going to give him all that he earned. He actually thought that he had the moral right to say that's too much money for him. I mean, what kind of arrogance is that? After you do the work and you generate the money, to have somebody who thinks that they are actually in a position to decide that how much money you are entitled to, just arbitrarily, that's too much money. That's straight up theft. And they talk about it in their own book. It's not me making this up. I'm Bob Law. We're at WWRL. And in a sense, we are.
Yes.
we had WBAI 99.5 in New York City walking us through the legacy of doo-wop is Bobby J. Bobby J is a radio personality, a television personality, a performer. When you sang with the teenagers, you took over the role that you were the bass singer. You took over the role that Sherman Garnes had.
Exactly. I stepped into Sherman's shoes.
And I remember you, now y'all are no longer teenagers, but you are on stage doing splits, dancing around it.
In fact, I won't tell you how old he is, but yesterday was Herman Santiago's birthday. I will say that Herman's gotten a little long in the tooth.
I guess so. If he was 13, 14, 15 in the early 1950s, indeed. Yeah. But now, the other thing that happened that was kind of interesting, when we talk about the creative bookkeeping, there was the cover songs. There were, the racism was there in the entertainment industry. White radio stations would not play a song by a black artist, no matter how wonderful the song might be. There were white radio stations that wouldn't play it, and that came all the way up on into the 70s. I read that WABC was music radio for teens back then. The program director was a guy named Rick Sklar, and Rick Sklar wouldn't play a song by a black artist, no matter how big the song was. Shaft or any Curtis Mayfield or Marvin Gaye, or he would not play it. I don't know if he even played Motown. Did he play Motown? Did he play the Supremes? And
yeah, he did. But you got to understand, they look, and for me, I was fortunate enough at WCBS-FM to work with Harry Harrison, to work with Bruce Morrow, to work with Ron Lundy, and to work with Dan Ingram, the guys who were the cornerstone of WABC. And they would tell me, they said, man, we used to listen to you guys at WWRL, and whatever made your top 16, we knew perhaps the following week might make it onto our chart. So it came down to the fact that we would start them, but they would chart them. So when the records became big, particularly Motown, that's when they found their way onto WABC. But WABC would not play it right out of the box.
Right. Now, there was a whole tradition of what were called cover songs. And one of the artists who covered the music mostly was Pat Boone. I mean, let's talk a little bit about Pat Boone and some of the songs that he covered.
Pat Boone, who I always tell people was my nemesis, because I used to talk about Pat on the air with his records like I'm Walking, and you played the Flamingos earlier. Well, before I Only Have Eyes for You, the Flamingos had a record called I'll Be Home, and they were so thrilled and happy. Zeke Carey told me this, because they were going to have their first crossover pop hit. But then Pat Boone recorded it, and Pat took it up the charts. Oh, are we still together, fellas?
Yeah, we're here.
And, okay. And Pat had Stagger Lee and Lloyd Price. You mentioned Lloyd?
Pat Boone covered Stagger Lee. And when we say covered, we don't mean that, you know, other artists sing various artists sing the same song. The cover song would come out. Tell us, what is the difference between other artists just singing the same song and a cover song?
Down through the years, and I've been taken to task about this, even today, people say, oh, yeah, you know, they're a cover act. They make cover songs. No, that record came out 20 years ago. That's not a cover. A cover record back in the day, in the 50s, if a record was moving up the charts, particularly by a black artist, they'd get a white artist to cover it. In other words, the analogy I always use is the cowboy movies. When the cowboy pulls out his gun and says, stick up your hands, I got you covered. That means I'm on you. And the white stations would not play those black artists, but they would play the same song as not so well interpreted by the white artist, and it would become a big hit. And Pat Boone used to gross about the fact that he wasn't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for a long time. I don't even know if he's in the Hall of Fame now. And I would say on the radio, Pat, it was Randy Wood who owns your label, Dot Records, he would say, "Hey Pat, I got this song. I want you to cover this." And Pat would have the big hit. I said, "Pat, shut up, man. Do you realize the money that you're making? You're taking care of your family. You got a big house out in California. Meanwhile, the black artists they're on hard times." Because he came out publicly once and said that the black artists wanted him to record their tune. not because they wrote them and they owned the publishing. We didn't know what publishing was.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Let me just say this. Aletha from Salisbury, Maryland. I really appreciate you, your $100 pledge to WBAI. Keep this programming and this station and keep this music alive. And Robert Dancy, $75 from Springfield Gardens in honor of the Cleftones from Queens. So I wonder, can I get somebody now from Fort Greene, somebody from Brooklyn? And what about somebody from Washington Heights? See if you can get through. The phone number is 212-209-2950. Maybe I said it too fast. 212-209-2950. If you call that number, you can make a pledge to WBAI. And we have the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop, Volume 1, a 4-CD set. Now, I can't play all the music here today, but you can hear all of the music. You can continue to enjoy this music. You can continue to relive the memories. If you make a $75 pledge or more, we have Renee Jones from the Bronx. Come on, Renee, go ahead. I guess the Bronx is close enough to Washington Heights. We give Frankie Lyman and the teenagers the credit for that. Thank you so much for calling in and for your $100. And as I say, for $75 or more, the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop, a 4-CD set. It's got the crest on here. It's got the Louis Flyman and the teen chords we mentioned earlier. It has the harp tones. It's got the Del Tears. It's got some groups I never even heard of, but it's got everybody on here. So much music. The Jive Five, the Turbans, When You Dance. I remember the Turbans, When You Dance. Now, when you listen to this music, I want you to just think about who you were when. Who you were with then, you know, when you listen to this music, it takes you back to when you were 14 years old, it takes you back to when you were 16 years old. And so when you think about going back to 16 years old, who were you with then? And maybe you're still with them now, you know, this love songs. And as we said earlier, these are kids. These are people 13, 14, 15 years old, writing the music and performing the music and encouraging us to love each other, you know? And so again, who is this? Shirley Belton from Staten Island. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for calling in. Kenneth Radcliffe. He's been listening since the beginning, and he's making his pledge, a pledge of $75 or more. And we'll send you in return to show our appreciation. I want to help you continue to relive the magic of some of the best memories of your life. We'll send you the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop, a 4-CD set. And I'm trying to keep up with who's calling, who's making these contributions. Ken Radcliffe, Duncan Campbell from the Bronx. So I guess we're counting the Bronx is Washington Heights, right? I need somebody from now. Where is Washington Heights? What are the streets? What streets? Let me ask you this, BJ. Where did Frankie Lyman live? Where did the teenager? What blocks and streets did they actually live on?
165th Street, 166th, 164th. That's the upper part of Harlem, the northern part of Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to say Jimmy Merchant was the only one who didn't really grow up in that area until he moved from the Bronx to Washington Heights.
Okay. Now, in the film, the film called The Five Heartbeats? There was a scene, a couple of scenes. That one was a scene where the singers drove back into the neighborhood. Everybody had a car. You remember that scene?
Yes, I do.
And there was another scene where they were traveling in the South, and they were pulled over by some good old boys and forced to get out of the car, since it was a group of black guys in the car, carload of black folk. These white sheriffs and these good old boys, the Proud Boys, they made them get out of the car and prove that they were singers and had them sing along the side of the road. Now, as I remember, those two scenes were actually based on some real experiences. Is that right?
Yes. The movie is called The Five Heartbeats, but the story and the musical consultants on the film were the Dells. Mm-hmm. That actually happened to the Dells.
Where they were forced out of the car.
They were, where you going? What you doing? Well, we're singers. We got to get, prove it. They made them get out of the car and sing on the street.
Mm. Now, what about the people driving back into the neighborhood in cars? Did that happen?
Well, I'm from Harlem myself, and even the teenagers from the upper part, Sugar Hill, Washington Heights, we rode the subway. We didn't have any cars. Even the Imperials in Brooklyn, they were on the F train. They didn't have cars. We had no cars in those days.
Or a driver's license. It was 13, 14 years old.
That's right. No driver's licenses.
Yeah.
Well, no.
Let me just come back to it for a minute. What? Say it again?
We rode the crosstown bus.
Right. Indeed, indeed. The coming back for just a minute to the cover songs. The some of those white artists, they built their careers. I don't know if you can say they built their entire career, but they had some major success with songs that by black artists. Janis Joplin had major success with "Take a Little Piece of My Heart," which was done originally by Irma Franklin, Aretha's sister.
Right.
And when they covered it, they sang it exactly the way the black artists sang it. Now, Peggy Lee, you know, Peggy Lee's known for Fever. That's like her signature song.
Right.
You know, it was a major song in moving her career forward, and it became her song. But she heard it first from this brother. Little Willie John. Bring it, Sean.
Give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, 'cause they don't know. Give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning and fever all through the night. Bless my soul, I love you. Take this heart away, take these arms I'll never use, and just believe.
Let me say again, this is WBAI 99.5. here in New York City. Bobby J is with us, and I'm Bob Law. We're talking about understanding the historical legacy of the music, where we came from, where we started. If you consider where we started, then you can look at where we are now in terms of popular music and the music that is being played on the air, on music stations, the music that young performers, particularly Black performers, are being encouraged to record and perform now. Just consider that and look back at this and look at where we have come from, look at what this music meant. And again, as I say, the children, the kids who sang this music understood that it was their mission to help envision a newer and better reality rather than reflect whatever negative realities were part of their environment. They were not trapped by their environment. They had a vision of a better reality, and their music addressed that vision. We talked about how this music had immediate crossover appeal. It was being accepted and appreciated and applauded by Blacks and whites. It was being performed by Blacks and whites. The Diamonds, Bobby J, the Diamonds were a white group, is that right?
From Canada.
From where?
Canada.
From Canada.
They were Canadian. David Somerville was the lead singer. He was a good friend of mine. And whatever, you know, when Why the Fools Fall in Love came out, they jumped on. They jumped right on the Nip Sip, the Clovers, the Diamonds jumped right on it.
Now,
and they built a whole career.
Yeah. Wow. Covered. But the music, but everybody bought the music, though. White audiences bought it. Black audiences bought it. It wasn't a crossover. It had immediate universal appeal.
Yes. Yes. It was about the music. It wasn't about anything political or anything racially motivated. It was the music. It had to be good. Otherwise, you weren't going to go out and buy it.
Yeah. And they did indeed buy it. And it helped to create a marketplace. Understand that it created a marketplace. There was no such thing as a teen market until these teenagers started to demonstrate their talent and their willingness to support their own product.
Yeah.
And it's important to understand this gave birth to what has become the music industry. There was no music industry. There was no concert promoters. There was no record promoters. There was no music industry. And then these teenagers, not just Frankie Lyman, but his brother as well, Jimmy Castor.
The literal teenagers.
Everybody. They planted the seeds. They laid the foundation.
Right.
And others came after them to reap what the these young people created, reap the fruits of what they planted. They didn't get paid. Didn't get paid really what they were entitled to
earned.
Because they didn't know what they were entitled
to. Right. Could I inject one thing, though? We were talking about covers. I was very good friends with Laverne Baker, who told me she was playing the Apollo Theater. She had a big record called Tweedly D. And she said she's on stage. And she looked out into the audience, and there was this white guy with music manuscript paper, and while she's singing, he's writing. And she's looking, what is he doing? Well, he wrote down the song, wrote all the notes, went downtown, gave it to a lady named Georgia Gibbs. We called her her Nibs, Miss Georgia Gibbs. Georgia Gibbs covered Tweedly D and went right to the top of the chart.
Mm-hmm.
Outsold Laverne Baker.
And one of the reasons that she outsold Laverne Baker is that she had a lot more outlets. There were radio stations that would play her song, would not play the same song by Laverne Baker. That was prior to 24-hour Black music radio.
Right. And they were on major labels at that time. Decca, Columbia, you know. And the records, the music that we were making were on small independent companies, small independent labels, who didn't have money to promote.
Didn't have the distribution at all. Couldn't get the record on the radio station anyway, even if they did.
Right.
You know, these are the children, these teenagers who created this industry. And as we said, this music, what was so attractive about this music is its universal appeal. We talked about the group from Canada. Listen to this, Little Darling by the Diamonds. And I didn't realize that the Diamonds were from Canada. Sean, bring it. There were a number of songs that had that kind of talking break in there where the performer...
That's a cover record. Originally done by the Gladiolas.
Mm. Another cover record.
Another cover record.
Mm-hmm. My. Boy. Let me just come back again. Let me just say this. Myron from Brooklyn has pledged. So we'll give Fort Greene credit for Myron from Brooklyn. Paul Dingoes from New Jersey and Ronald from Corona. Thank you, brothers. Thank you for your call. Thank you for pledging your $75 or more. And in return, we're going to send you the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop Volume 1. It's a 4-CD set. Got plenty of music. It's got a whole lot more music than we could possibly play here today. And we'll make sure that you get this music so that you can listen to it all summer long. And like I say, you ought to introduce it to your children and your grandchildren. They are particularly grandchildren. You've got grandchildren who don't know what four-part harmony is. They don't know what music is. And so help them. Gustavo and Beverly from Jamaica, thank you for your pledge. Thank you so much for pledging. So I need you to call right now. We'll take the 16th caller from Queens. We'll take 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950, a $75 pledge. And you would get a copy of the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop. A 4-CD set. It's got so much music on here that you can continue to listen to and enjoy this music. Let me just again. There was another era. You know, we talk about all these groups and these love songs. Then there were also the girl groups. Can you talk a little bit about the girl groups?
Well, the girl groups. They looked at the success of the boy groups, and. There, you know, you can go back to the Andrews Sisters in the 40s and into the 50s, a group called the Cookies. They were picked up by Ray Charles because they were on the same label, Atlantic Records. He made them the Ray Letts.
Mm.
And then you had from the Bronx, the Chantels with angelic voices. And they still have those angelic voices. And then you had from Passaic, New Jersey, the Shirelles, who looked at the success of the Chantels and said, wow, this is something we could do. Mm-hmm. And then from Spanish Harlem came the Ronettes.
Mm.
And Ronnie Spector, who unfortunately passed away last month, Frankie Lyman, was the love of her life. She patterned herself after Frankie Lyman. And then in Detroit, you had the Supremes, who was looking at the teenagers. Why do fools fall in love? Because in 1981, their lead singer, Diana Ross, had another big hit record with her version of Why Do Fools Fall in Love. So it's all related.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Chantels, the Shirelles. Yeah. Let me give you an idea of what that sounded like. The Chantels. How many people remember this song? And when you hear this song, I want you to think about who were you with then? When you were 14 years old, maybe you were 16 years old. Who, not just your romantic, the romance in your life at the time, but yeah, think about that. But also your running buddies, your partners. Where were y'all hanging out? And when this song was on the charts, here's the Chantels. Hit it. Bring it, Sean.
This is dedicated to the one
That's the Shirelles.
Yes.
And this is dedicated to the one I love. The song by the Chantels is Maybe. See if we can find that and share that with you as well. But as we say, that preceded the Shirelles, preceded the Supremes. And yes. And the Shirelles turned out hit after hit. And prior to the Shirelles, Bobby, you point out it was the Chantels.
Yes. The Chantels from the Bronx. There's a street named after them in the Bronx.
Say it again.
There's a street named after the Chantels in the Bronx.
Is that right?
That's right.
At the time that they were singing, it was not even on the radar screen that a street would be named after them.
That's right.
It was not even a possibility at that time. They had no idea. We didn't even know you could get streets named after people. I don't know if Sean, if you were able to. Okay, good. Let me share, as we promised. Let me share the Chantels. Maybe, yeah. Sean. It is cold outside, so move it a little bit closer to your radio. Get a warm beverage. Stay with me. We've got some more music. We're moving toward the bottom of the hour. We're going to try to get in as much music as we can. And I want to thank everybody who's been calling in. For the folks who are calling and making their pledge, you really are going to enjoy this encyclopedia of doo-wop. This is a 4-CD set that has so much of the music. And even this 4-CD set can't contain all the music. But there's so much music, but there's a lot on this CD that will help you enjoy the whole summer. You know, and as I say, introduce this music to your children, and particularly those of you who are old enough to have grandchildren. If you are old enough to have some grandchildren, then you've got some young people who don't even know what music is. Play this music, but play it for yourself and think about who were you with back then when you were 16 years old and the Chantels were talking about Maybe. And Bobby J, when you listen to that the lead singer, you hear that voice. I mean, that was some remarkable talent. And as we said earlier, these are people who did not necessarily go to music school or take music lessons. It was just a natural talent.
Right. That was Arlene Smith. Great voice.
Arlene Smith.
Yes.
And now, where were the Chantels from?
The Bronx.
They were from the Bronx. I think we just got a caller from the Bronx, too, or someone who from the Bronx who just pledged their $75. You can pledge $75 or more if you like. We'll take a little bit more if it is at all possible. There's Frank Al Hakim from Bayshore, and then there's Marvin Dendy from New Hyde Park, and Daniel from Rosedale. Lacey from Harlem says that she from the streets is Bob Law with Bob Law is her favorite program. Go ahead, Lacey. And from Corona, there's Ron from Corona, and there's Ron from Brooklyn. And then there's Yvonne for a $200 pledge from Brooklyn. Thank you, Yvonne. That kind of pledge helps to lift our spirits here, helps to encourage us to want to stay here and create programming. And keep in mind, again, this is programming that you can't get anywhere else. Not in New York City, not on the talk shows, not on the music stations, particularly not on the music stations. They would be afraid to take any risk and venture out and explore the music the way we're able to do here. So it is important that we keep this station alive. You can call. Did I give you the number lately? We'll take calls right now. 212-209-2950. I'm Bob Law. With me is Bobby J, the legendary Bobby J. As I said earlier, Bobby J is a national treasure. He really is. And he is a griot in the truest sense of the word. He lives the music. He experiences it. And he shares that experience. This is not from research or observing anybody else. He's the person that people come to if they want to do a book. And I'm through twisting his arm to do the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I hear you.
Yeah, you hear good. Everybody else who wants to do a book, in order to make their book authentic, they go talk to Bobby J. And we have an opportunity to talk with Bobby J right now, and I greatly appreciate that. Let's talk quickly about the classic doo-wop. We mentioned earlier the Dells. Now,
yes.
What happened to the Dells while they were traveling through the South, the American South, and they were pulled over by some good old boys, sheriffs, policemen, forced to get out of the car and sing to prove that they were really singers. And of course, those good old boys didn't really need proof. They just took any opportunity they could to humiliate some black people. Mm-hmm. But as it turned out, the group that they stopped really were the Dells, who really could sing. And they produced some classic music. The I want to share some of that with you. All right. The and we'll talk a little bit about the Dells. The lead singer of the Dells, what was his name?
Marvin Jr.
I was telling some folks in Detroit about him. If you listen carefully to the Dells, you can hear the seeds that were planted that produce people like Teddy Pendergrass. If you hear Marvin Jr. and you hear Teddy Pendergrass, you say, that's where it came from. Marvin Jr. and the Dells.
Marvin, I did an interview at WWRO with them, which I'm going to broadcast on my internet show in a couple of months or so. But I said that to Marvin. Marvin said, he said that's Teddy Pendergrass. That's my son.
He certainly sounds like it. Yeah. Just before the Dells, tell us about your internet show. How can people hear you?
Well, I'm on BossJockRadio.com. It's on Sunday nights, 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And I just have a ball because I do what I want to do, and I play what I want to play, and I cover the entire spectrum. So that's Bobby J's Great Soul Performances, BossJockRadio.com, 7 to 9 p.m. Sunday nights.
BossJockRadio.com.
Right.
Just go online. Boss is saying boss. B-O-S-S. Boss.
Right. BossJockRadio.com.
I'm sorry. We were saying it at the same time. You say it again one more time.
BossJockRadio.com.
And it's on Sunday night. You can listen to Bobby J and hear the music. Continue to hear and enjoy this music. We talked about...
And in fact, let me just jump in there. If you listen tomorrow night, you're going to hear people that we were just talking about. Ralph Cooper, WHOM in New York, and from WINS 1010 Winds, Alan Freed. I'm saluting those two disc jockeys tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back in a minute and see if we can talk a little bit more about some of those disc jockeys. But here, let me share with you the Dells. Bring it, Sean.
Squeeze you deep. That's why I
Sean, I don't know if you can still hear me. My chat box is doesn't seem to be working all of a sudden. I don't know how to put it back. put it back online. But if you can, let's see if we can't fix this right on the spot. Bobby J, are you with me?
That song still gets to me. In the key of G. Oh, what a night.
So, Sean, if you can hear me, we have our own formula for how long we're going to play the music. So we have to go back to the formula. Don't wait for me.
Okay.
All right. Okay, good. I don't know what's happening on my screen, but it is, as they say nowadays, it is what it is. Classic doo-wop. And we're going to play a little bit more of that by the songs by the Dells. And in a minute, you'll hear the Teddy Pendergrass all up in the music that Marvin Jr. Before there was a Teddy Pendergrass, there was a Marvin Jr. Indeed.
Right.
I want to thank a lot of people. People are calling. I can't get to all. I don't know what's going on with my phones and things now. I can't get to everybody. Sandra Ramos says that she was in reform school listening to my show. So she's talking about Night Talk. If she was in reform school listening to my show, he was listening to me on Night Talk at WWRL here in New York. And she now runs a battered shelter for women. And she says, thank you, Bob. But Sandra, thank you so much. Thank you for the work that you are doing and providing a service, a much needed service in this community. And she's from Ringwood, New Jersey. David Brinkley. And he's from Plainfield, New Jersey. Carol Riley from Amityville. Was anybody, were there any doo-wop groups from Amityville, from Long Island? I don't know Ken Webb, who was
that's where Kenny's from.
Just jockey at WBLS and for a short time at WWRL. He's from Amityville, and I think he said he had a group back there.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that. Yeah, call him up over on SiriusXM, but I doubt it.
Mm-hmm. Now, and also from Princeton, this I think is Getal from Princeton donated. He pledged $100 for a pledge of $75 or more. And thank you. Thank you for your pledge of $100. Thank you for everybody who was calling in, trying to get their pledge in while we are still on the air. Thank you so much. And you really are going to enjoy this encyclopedia of doo-wop. It's got so much music that helps you it'll help you relive the magic and relive some of the best memories of your life. And they really were. It is the 50s has been called an innocent time, but there was a great deal of, I started moving papers around. Y'all don't want me to move the papers, right? But the 50s was called an innocent time. But when you listen to this music, you understand a code of behavior and a set of values that were being developed and promoted through the music and helping to nurture a much healthier community in spite of unemployment, violence. There was gang banging back in the 50s. But in spite of all of that, this music taught us to love each other, taught us to embrace each other. And it's important to understand that that is the part of the significant legacy of this music. And it was being created by children. They were 13, 14, 15 years old. These were kids creating this music, writing these songs, arranging these songs. And then came Bobby J. It seems to me that when it began, it was like how many instruments? It was a cappella, and then it was very few people, even in the, not very few people, there was a cappella, there were very few instruments, and then some of that began to change. However, the music, it seemed like the music kind of expanded. And it was being taken more, it sounds like it was being taken more seriously by the record companies. And, mm-hmm. and so you get, mm-hmm. you know, can we talk about what triggered that?
Well, first of all, you got to remember, when we were young kids and we were recording, we recorded with a rhythm section, piano, bass, drums, guitar, and usually a tenor saxophone. That was it. So the voices had to be there. You know, when you talk about a cappella, we sung a cappella when we used to rehearse because we didn't have musicians around us.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, thanks to groups like the Persuasions, people began to understand and appreciate a cappella singing. But as we moved from when I first started recording, it was a single track. It was just one track. And then we went three tracks, where they'd have the lead singer on one track, the background vocals on another one, and the whole band on the third track. Then when multi-track came along, they said, oh, you know, we're 8-track and then 16-track and then 24-track. Let's fill up the tracks. And then they started putting in the strings and the flutes and the congas, and you know.
Hmm.
And then the emphasis was less on the vocals.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. The platters. Can yes. the platters in that category?
Well, the platters came along almost simultaneously with the teenagers. However, the platters were older. They were in their early 20s, early to mid-20s, and they were singing more sweet love songs, and they could play in the club. They could play in the Copacabana type venues, and they went all over the world too.
Mm-hmm. Here's an example.
Mercury Records with bigger budgets. A guy named mm-hmm. Buck Ram, who was their Svengali, their manager. He wrote most of the songs. He formed a corporation for the platters, of which he was, of course, the principal owner. Mm. And if anybody left the platters, he would buy them out. And, you know, it was...
A lot of funny stuff going on.
Yeah. Everybody, you know, it was a lot of creative accounting.
Yep.
Companies had three sets of books.
Now, in the audience, we had no idea of all of those things that were going on. All we knew, as well as the performers, all we knew
right.
was the music and
right.
what the music
right.
said, what the music made you feel. The planters. Here's the right. I guess one of the I don't know if you can say their biggest hit, but they had some they had a number of really significant hits.
Yes.
This one
yes.
is also a song that a lot of other artists have performed. But this is the Platters. Who were you with when the Platters did The Great Pretender? Bring it, Sean.
Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender. Pretending that I'm doing well. My need is such, I pretend too much. I'm lonely, but no one can tell. Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender. Adrift in a world of my own. I play the game, but to my real shame, you've left me to dream all alone.
Bob Law, Bobby J is with me. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in the city. We're looking at this celebration of Black History Month, and we're looking back at the history of doo-wop, history of the music in this, the beginnings of the teen market, the beginnings of the record, what is now the record industry. And it was sparked. It really was sparked by these young kids from the street corners in New York City, street corners in Philadelphia. Bobby J, where did you perform And you know, you said the kids didn't know about making money from the records, but they did know about, they expected to make money in performances, but they were 14 and 15 years old. Mm-hmm. Was there much performing going on?
Oh, there was a lot. There was a lot. There were a lot of clubs. There was the, your VFW clubs and other places. But the goal, if you got a hit record, your goal was to play the world-famous Apollo Theater,
mm-hmm.
where we did 5 and 6 shows a day.
5 and 6 shows a day.
That's right. That's right. Goodness.
Now, do you remember how much you were getting paid then?
Very little. I remember when the Latins played the Apollo, I think we got $500 for the week.
Mm-hmm.
6 shows. Wow. Now you divide that up. 6 shows a day, $500 for the week.
For the entire week, 6 shows a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, you know, back in the 50s, and one of the reasons people didn't realize that they were money was being stolen from them, you know, back in the 50s, adults had jobs making $50 a week.
Right.
Salaries of $45 and $50 a week. If you made $60 or $80 a week, that was considered a really good job.
Yeah.
And so if you got $500 a week, coming from a family where maybe your father was the head of the family, right, making $70 or $80 or even $50 a week. Right. That's one of the reasons people didn't understand that they were being beaten out of the money. That means we got to hurry.
Right. There's
some other
right.
music I wanted people to hear. There were some great songs. 1,000 Miles Away. That was the Heartbeats.
Yes.
And then we talked about Little Anthony, Tears on My Pillow, Little Anthony. And I'm going to see if I can put both of those together. Sean, let's do 1,000 Miles Away, and then we'll kind of segue into Tears on My Pillow, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about that, all right? So, Sean, as James Brown would say, hit me, Sean.
You're 1,000 miles away. You remember you by. Oh, my darling, dry your eyes. Daddy's coming home soon. On my knees every day. Just for you, hope you always want me to. Daddy's coming home soon. But no matter what the day is, I'm going to make it my business to get home soon. Your eyes, Daddy's coming home soon.
in my heart caused by you.
You.
If we could start anew, I wouldn't hesitate. I'd gladly take you.
So that's, you know, Bobby J, those voices. That, those are remarkable voices. Look at this little Anthony from Fort Greene in Brooklyn. Remarkable, remarkable voices. And I wonder, how old was little Anthony then?
He would have been in 58 when he did that. He was about 17.
He was about 17. And you say he wrote that?
No, he didn't write that. He didn't write that one.
Okay. Yeah, because that is something, though. Alfred Gilman Bay from Brooklyn. So we give Alfred his pledge of $150, and we give that credit to little Anthony. But Brooklyn is, Fort Greene is close enough. So in honor of little Anthony and the Imperials. And Joseph Fredericks from Staten Island. Thank you, Joseph, so much. George from Brooklyn. Thank you for the for your pledge. And you will receive a copy of the Encyclopedia of Doo-Wop. You're gonna love this 4-CD set. We really have to hurry. I'm about to run out of time. I'm not gonna be able to get to all the music. I want you to hear this though. I wanted you to hear The Love We Had by the Dells. But this song now. But instead of that, let me come here to Frankie Lymon again, and the song Goody Goody.
Right.
That was a what you talked about earlier about how the music was so powerful, or not just so powerful, but how the music began to change and had a bigger, bolder sound. The Goody Goody is an example of that, or was it Goody Goody that triggered that change?
Well, Goody Goody came along at the time. Now you got to put this in context. The entire career of Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers was 18 months.
Mm.
January 1956 through July 1957, it was over. The people at the record company decided, you know, Frankie Lymon is the star. You know, we need to put him out there by himself, and we'll see what we can do with the group, which they didn't. They didn't do much with the group. But then they began to give Frankie more adult-sounding material. With Rudy Traylor's orchestra, big band sound. The original Goody Goody was recorded by Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers, but by the time the record got out, they brought Frankie back from England into New York, re-recorded it, took the guys off, put on, I don't know, the Ray Charles singers or the Anita Kerr singers, and that's the story.
We're about to run out of time. I think I got to get out, Sean. I'm supposed to get out now, right? So to get out a few minutes earlier.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Edward, I don't know what I should leave with. We like to kind of leave on an upbeat. Well, no, I really want you to. Well, I don't have time anyway. I want people to hear Marvin Jr. and The Love We Had stayed on our mind, and so we'll go with that. Bobby J, thank you so much. Thank you for helping us on this journey. Thank you so much. All right, now. And Sean, so I'm looking for, let's do The Dells and The Love We Had. We'll be back, and we'll come back to some conversations about what's going on in New York City politically. But just remember this, The Love We Had stays on our mind. Bring it, Sean.
and pretty girl. I've been remembering the good times that we used to share. My thoughts of you don't have an end. And memories of you are everywhere.
But why should I tell?
The love we had stays on my mind. Girl, if you were nearer, if you had a mirror, maybe you could count my tears. And if you were nearer, it would all be clearer. How I wish that you.
I'm in the middle of a social experiment to see whether it's possible to live in Manhattan and never leave my apartment.
One of the founders at WBAI of Freeform Radio, Larry Josephson, a Peabody Award-winning radio producer, pioneering Freeform Radio host, and a dad, Larry the J. He never planned to be a morning radio sensation.
I became kind of against the morning and also against all the other morning men at the time. They were all treacle, you know, hi-ho. At 5 a.m, they were happy and energetic, and I wasn't. I was often depressed or tired.
But he was a sensation.
It started to attract more and more people, all by word of mouth. And at some point, maybe in the first year, all kinds of many members of the intelligentsia, the culture vultures, the arts mavens, started listening to my show, and would call in, and it became a hit.
Join us Sunday, December 4th at 1 p.m. at Symphony Space for a memorial celebration of the late, great Larry Josephson. You'll need to mask up. Symphony Space is at 95th Street and Broadway in Manhattan, or you can listen on the radio station where Larry first did his radio programs on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming also at WBAI.org. That's December 4th at 1 p.m. Symphony Space, or right here on your radio station.
Breathe.
Brooklyn. I have no complaints on WBAI. I'm very happy with everything.
My name is Anthony. Is it possible to create an app? Would that help build up the base if someone could just put an app on their phone, click on it and get to BAI, like you get to other radio stations?
This is Rose from Flemington, New Jersey. There are a lot of young people. Is there any way we can provide them with some college credit for volunteering? And it doesn't have to be on Atlantic Avenue. They can get together and do it remotely. Am I making any sense?
If you'd like to add your thoughts to the ongoing conversation regarding the work of the WBAI Local Station Board, then tune in Tuesday, December 6th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. for the second report of 2022 from the WBAI Local Station Board. This month, you'll be introduced to various members of the board. They'll talk about their responsibilities, recent developments throughout the network, and ask you for your ideas on how to build a stronger WBAI. Please keep in mind, this is your chance to interact with the board members on the show, so don't let this opportunity pass you by. Again, that's Tuesday, December 6th, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., for the second report of 2022 from the WBAI Local Station Board. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
Greetings and salutations. This is Giovanni Anglin.
And I'm Bastian Nissa. Along with intern Mike, you could catch us live on Thursday from midnight to 2 a.m.
You know what, Bash? Our tagline is that this is the show about nothing, but it's more than that, right?
That's true. Our conversations could be political, but also comical. We're really just giving our point of view on how we see the world and how it affects us today.
So join us Thursdays at midnight, BAI listeners, only on 99.5 FM, WBAI New York.